Today's class is the last of a series of 10. The title of today's class is New Testament and Justice, Poverty, Hope, and Resurrection. And there's sort of an overarching question that that I'd like us to have in the back of our minds, which is, where is God in our predicament today? And where is the promise of the feast to come, or the foretaste of the feast to come? I think we'll begin with the handing out. There's a little exercise here. And it's a nonverbal exercise, so it'll be a little bit difficult to convey this over the tape. However, what we're going to be doing is handing out some cartoons, which is a series of pictures. And when the cartoons come fully around the circle, Lori will describe what they are.
So if you could go ahead and give Carl, as you get the cartoon, we'll pass it all the way around the circle. This is a short history of America by cartoonist R. Crumb. I think he died recently. And what you might eat, if you'll notice at the top of each cartoon, there's a number. If you would, just as you look at this, decide for yourself at which stage of history you would prefer for things to be. Just remember that number and we'll discuss that afterwards. All right. So, let's start passing.
Well, you're passing cartoons around. You're supposed to decide which stage of history. I haven't seen them yet.
It's a short history of America in picture.
Short history.
If you could pass that over to me when you get a chance.
He wants it.
Oh, okay. This is the same.
Why don't I go ahead and describe it?
Okay.
The first cartoon describes a scene that is just shows creatures of nature, some deer, a meadow, trees, birds, but no evidence of human habitation. The second cartoon shows that exact same scene, but now trees are cleared in the center and the railroad tracks have been laid and a railroad train is running along the tracks. But everything else is pretty much natural as it was. The third cartoon shows that exact same scene, but now we see telephone wires and poles along the railroad right-of-way, a path with a horse-drawn cart and a log cabin alongside the road. All the other trees and meadows and the shape of the landscape is the same. There are a couple birds in the air. The fourth cartoon shows that same landscape, but there are now more telephone wires. There are some signs, a couple more homes. The trees have been trimmed, and there is now a fence around the cabin, and a porch has been put on the cabin as well. The fifth cartoon shows now some evidence of some business activity, and a town is developing. Some additional cabins are there. Most of the trees have been cut off. There are still a few prominent trees there. many wires along the telephone poles adjacent to the railroad. There's an additional set of rail lines, and so there's much more activity. The sixth cartoon, just as in along this general trend, we now see an industry with a smokestack, still a horse-drawn cart. It looks like this is Main Street, several other vehicles in the distance, and only one tree left standing of the from the original landscape. The seventh cartoon now shows, and it running parallel to the railroad lines, a two sets of trolley car tracks and a trolley car, and still a horse-drawn carriage. telephone lines are hanging everywhere. The original cabin that was at this intersection is now replaced with a hot dog stand, and just generally, this is now a very commercialized district. But it's still before the age of automobiles. Okay, the eighth cartoon shows that same scene, much more intense development. One tree left standing of the in the original landscape. Now automobiles are very congested at this intersection. The eighth cartoon.
Nine.
It just shows somewhat more modern automobiles, increased congestion, telephone wires, and streetlight electrical cables are everywhere.
And the tree's gone.
And oh yes, and the last tree has been cut down, so there's no evidence other than some grass on the road. Any evidence of life other than one person on a street corner. The 10th cartoon just shows tremendous concentration of commercial activity, billboards everywhere, cars everywhere, just very active. Lots of development. The 11th shows now at this intersection a used car lot, gas stations, large modern automobiles, still even more development. The 12th slide shows cars everywhere, motorcycles, same scene, but just larger, more modern buildings and more modern cars. And then there's a caption at the bottom. There's a question here, and it's sort of like this is this depiction of the world as it is today. The question is, what next? So now the next three slides are possible scenarios for the future. The first scenario of the future shows the same scene, but it's headed with the title The Fun Future, Techno Fix on the March. And we see something looking like the Jetsons cartoon. Everybody's kind of flying around in spacecraft. There are some trees and grass, but it's very, very high tech and modern and clean and very well planned also, it looks like.
Looks like solar energy.
Yeah, it looks like we've got some solar
solar panels,
and there's a sign on the ones in front of one home. It says no ground vehicles in this sector. The second scenario is entitled The Ecotopian Solution, and you see trees everywhere. It looks like a dirt path, people riding bicycles, and you've got a vegetable stand. You've got a tree house in one of the trees. You've got simple A-frame made out of wood here. Lots of little, very small-scale primitive or at least simple dwellings. There's a person sitting under a tree playing a banjo, and another person right alongside him playing a violin. So there's a lot of music here. And there's a public drinking fountain. So it looks like there's some public infrastructure here, but it's all very simple. The dominant feature in this landscape, though, is trees, lots of trees.
That looks like Russia, East Berlin, about 40 years ago.
The last slide, last cartoon, is entitled Worst Case Scenario, Ecological Disaster, and it shows the same scene as we saw before, but all the buildings are essentially dilapidated, almost melted under a glaring hot sun, and the automobiles are rusted hulks, and nothing appears to be alive, and the buildings are cracked. The roofs are falling in. It's a pretty sad sight. There is absolutely no evidence of any life at all. So this is an example of apocalyptic, an example of a world that is going to change. And the suggestion here is that change is occurring rapid, and whatever happens in the future, the world that we know today is coming to an end. The question is, what will the future hold for us? What will this new world be? There's a lot in the Bible that is that talks in these kinds of apocalyptic terms about ends. And new beginnings.
Well, I'd like to just first ask if you observed, or which picture kind of fit where you'd most like to be. Did you notice?
Well, I thought I was for the last one.
the ecotopian. Oh no, the ecological disaster one.
Disaster.
That's original.
People there, obviously, mm-hmm. not there, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. really primitive, or else mm-hmm.
What? Ecotopian.
Ecotopian? Yeah. You like the ecotopian?
Yeah. Get them with a bicycle.
Did anyone want a little more development before they entered the picture?
Yeah, I had written down, I think, number four, mm-hmm. which had not just one or two houses, but maybe three or four mm-hmm. houses around. And that seemed to be realistic for me because I'm about to make a move out of the city in our own lives out to a smaller city, and we're going to be living on the edge of that, mm-hmm. so on the edge of the smaller city with access to rural living. So I said, well, it's probably realistic I really am thinking now. So it would be like number four.
So you don't want to be too isolated from other people. Want the rural life, but not too. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Having experienced the city, you're ready for something a little less intense, it sounds like.
It probably would have been about number 10, the city.
Right.
with the
You're probably now kind of around slide 10 or 11, and you want to get back to slide 4 or 5.
Any other feedback about?
I wasn't willing to commit to any particular slide. The second and third to the last were appealing, but I wouldn't want to spend my whole life living in either one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it makes sense to have different types of infrastructure for different areas.
Mm-hmm.
So you might actually like to see not an either or, but perhaps different areas experiment with different types of futures.
Sure.
Yeah.
Anything else you noticed about the pictures? Any surprises or? One thing that I know.
Wildlife disappeared, basically.
Yeah, pretty quickly, too. Something I noticed about myself was, I forget now which slide was, I think about number six, I was noticing all the development, and suddenly I noticed there was it's more like number nine, yeah. The log cabin, I noticed things had gotten more developed, and I thought, something's missing, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And it wasn't until I heard Carl describe it that it was the tree, the last tree. And it's like, oh, I noticed something was missing, but I couldn't figure out what it was. And that's a little embarrassing.
That's kind of a sore spot with Lori and I, because it kind of reminds us of her church. There are some members of her congregation that love to cut down trees. I think that they have this irresistible urge to, when they see a tree, to want to cut it down.
Well, that's a little bit of an extreme description. But what it is in two cases there have been trees, one that was a silk tree that was dropping these beautiful but messy flowers on the parking lot and on cars. And the person who just took on herself the responsibility in keeping things cleaned up got tired of it and decided she would hire someone to cut the tree down. And it happened to be in a time when most of the staff was on vacation. And when we came back, the tree was gone. And it was just, it was one of those experiences where you realize it provided shade. It was beautiful. We always enjoy it in the summer.
And they did the same thing again 2 years later when most of the staff was on vacation. Another tree was gone. Probably so the last.
Was there any discussion about where that popped up?
Yeah, it really is a clue that what happens on the environment has an impact on people. And it's not just the shade and the beauty, but there's an emotional attachment too. And I don't think the problem is solved. You can look at it in a positive way and say, this person showed initiative. But there is a point at which...
Initiative.
Pardon?
Mutinous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and really not being aware of how it impacts other
people. It was callous initiative.
Yeah, yeah. So...
Anyway, that was just a little aside there. But the first theme we're going to be talking about, having looked at some of these apocalyptic scenarios of the future, is the theme of salvation and grace in the New Testament.
Well, I'd just like to start by acknowledging that not all people believe when we talk about salvation. There are many who believe that salvation only includes people. And I have a quote from the writer Daniel Quinn, who wrote the novel Ishmael. I don't know if you've read it, but it's a fictional account, and it's a conversation between a human being and a gorilla. And the gorilla has this wealth of knowledge that he exchanges with the human being. And Quinn, the writer, is an environmentalist. But he said that, his quote is, Jesus didn't come to save the whale. And it's hard to find a basis in Christianity for a caring stance in the world. The Bible is filled with nothing but condemnation. When people read Ishmael, it's like manna. He grew up in the Catholic Church. He's no longer part of the Catholic Church. I think that he's not the only one. I have a good friend who's been really involved in environmentalism and is a committed Presbyterian. And one of her frustrations in environmental circles is the assumptions by people of other faiths or people outside religious traditions who assume that Christianity is excluding the rest of creation. So what I'd like to start with today is actually looking at a couple of places in the New Testament. One is focusing on, again, compassion and justice that is a theme throughout the scriptures, and also particularly the universal salvation that Paul talks about in his letters. And if you could look up Romans 8, 22-25. This is probably the most famous and familiar passage. I believe that some people could still read it and question whether the salvation is for all of creation, but let's just look at it and discuss it. John, do you have it?
Yeah.
starting with 22.
Yeah, 22 through 25.
We know that the whole creation has been groaning in travail together until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience.
Thank you. In our other classes about discussing the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament, we discussed how, particularly in the second creation story in Genesis 2, there is a very clear sense in which God delights and creates all of creation, and there's a sense of companionability between humanity and creatures. The creatures are made so that Adam won't be alone. And that then is picked up in Paul's writing in discussing salvation and the coming of Christ, which is that the whole creation has been groaning, and we ourselves are part of that creation. Now, I think it's helpful to think about what salvation means. In Ed Schrader's class a few days ago, he defined salvation as meaning to heal and to save. And in that regard, this is a really apt theme for us to look at, because we're certainly in a position now where we can identify with the groaning and the need for salvation and healing and liberation. If we look at ourselves as oppressors, not just of other people who don't share the wealth particularly that we have in this country, but we also include that oppression to, if we expand that oppression to include other creatures, then the need for salvation we can see today is even more important for the whole creation. Another concept that I've just discovered since I came here to Holden is through the writing of Joseph Sittler, who's a Lutheran theologian. And a point that he makes that I think is really important, he talks about the narrowness of our concept of stewardship. That has been the traditional way in the church of talking about taking care of the planet, taking care of the earth. And he remarks that stewardship is a perfectly good word and a very powerful idea, but it's not a big enough doctrine. It's not central enough. For nothing less than the doctrine of grace would be an adequate doctrine to shape the Christian community's mind and practice in a way appropriate to the catastrophe in the environment. God creates the creation in grace. The creation itself is a realm of grace. And once again, this goes back to, if we see ourselves as separate from creation, we're going to have a hard time really grasping what he means. But if we see ourselves as fellow creatures, and that our whole lived experience is in our bodies, in this creation, then our ability to experience grace and transformation comes about with our very participation in nature, in creation. So I think that is a, and as long as we focus only on stewardship, we're really seeing ourselves as managers. I think what Sittler's talking about and other writers is that rather than being managers of creation, we're really called to be lovers of creation in intimate, caring, compassionate relationship, seeing ourselves intertwined. On the hike up to Holden a couple days ago, I was by myself and I walked along the path and I looked up to see this doe and her fawn. And you know, you get so used to seeing deer around here, it's, you don't want to get numb to it, but it was still a surprise. And the thing about it is, she stood on the path, you know, it's a very narrow little path, and she stood about 6 feet away from me, and we just stared at each other. And I could see the little fawn, really young one, kind of hovering in the back. And I kept thinking, okay, no, what? I don't want to chase her off. I mean, she was probably on the path before me. So we stood there for a long time, and I thought, well, okay, I'm going to step off into the brush and let her come through. And I stepped off, but there wasn't a very far distance from the path for me to go to. It was really thick. And she started coming toward me, which really surprised me. You know, I thought, she's pretty bold. And then she got about 4 feet away and decided to just go up the path on the up off the trail on the other side. But the fawn continued to come closer to me till it was about maybe 3.5 feet away. And the whole point of this is that in that extended period of just sort of looking at each other, and there was definitely some sort of communication, like, who, you know, who's got the right of way? Or, you know, how are we going to make this passing? And I, you know, I guess what I find such a gift in that is the opportunity to recognize in it my relationship to these other creatures.
I had a conversation with a man who grew up Jewish, who recently, well, 20 years ago, converted to Lutheranism, but he was raised Jewish and was a devout Jew for most of his life, and is very familiar with Jewish customs, Jewish scripture, and thinking. And we were talking, he had given a sermon about the need to think Hebraically when reading the Bible. And we talked a little bit afterward about that. And he said that one of the things that he felt was a real difference between a Middle Eastern view of the world and a Western view of the world is that Middle Eastern people look at the world very holistically. They see the interconnections of things, and Western people tend to look at the world reductionistically. They parcel things out, compartmentalize things, categorize things, separate things. And even though we obviously can't read the Bible strictly from an ecological standpoint, because 2,000 years ago the ecological crisis was not at all understood. It was barely understood just 20 or 30 years ago. Nevertheless, Hebrews were accustomed to thinking very holistically, and it is not probably too great a stretch to extrapolate a lot of what they were saying about the interconnections of human communities and the need to be kind to the land and to be kind to animals, all of which is in Leviticus. And to think now, okay, how does that perhaps affect our thinking about what our kindness toward nature in general, and what reverence for nature suggests ought to be our proper relationship to nature? And so even though people in Jesus' time did not think ecologically as we do today, I think it is nevertheless instructive to sometimes read the parables as though they were taking an ecological perspective. For example, the prodigal son. You can kind of read that from the standpoint of prodigal humanity going out on a binge and spending their inheritance to the point where there's nothing left for this individual but to eat with the pigs. That when you spend it all, that's all that's left. And then hopefully there's something to come home to. The parables of the lost sheep and the lost pearl, you know, if we read these from an ecological standpoint, perhaps there's that will help us to do what Buzz Kahn was saying we need to do, which is to think more Hebraically.
And if we move from the frame of the mindset of looking at ourselves as managers of creation to fellow creatures in creation, we are also expressing what Logan described as I-Val relationships. There are a couple of ways of looking at the world. An I-It relationship is relating to each other and to God and to creation in such a way that you look at that person to, how can they help me? Or how can I use this? And that is enhanced in our culture because of our economic system. We look at things, you know, how will this help me? It, maybe professor could say an example of their students in class, is there going to be a test on this? It's like very utilitarian. Whereas I think the scriptures, both Hebraic and the New Testament, really call us to loving, compassionate, just relationship. And maybe even in more modern terms, a loving, vibrant lover relationship. I mean, which in fact is even in Hebraic scriptures, you'll see in the Song of Solomon, which we never even used, we'll have to add. And finally, in another theme in the New Testament, if you look up Matthew 25, starting with verse 31, again, this is, the scripture was not written with ecological concerns in mind. But I think for our time today, if we think of who is most oppressed, who is the least of these, we'll have a strong message from this passage also. That's starting with verse 31. Todd, do you have it?
Yeah.
Can you read 31 through 40?
Through 40.
Yeah.
Okay. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep at his right hand, but the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink? And when did we see thee a stranger and welcome thee, or naked and clothe thee? And when did we see thee sick or in prison and visit thee? And the king will answer them, Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me.
If we do believe that, as in Romans we saw, the whole creation is groaning for liberation, and if we can open our minds to believe that the least of these and Christ may even be encountered in our environment, I think this parable has a very potent message.
This gets to the theme of justice in the Bible, which is, pervades the Old Testament and the New Testament. And as Laurie suggested, one way to interpret the Last Judgment passage is maybe the least of these of our brethren are other creatures who are endangered. Another way of interpreting that is more anthropocentrically or human-centeredly, that the least of those that we need to be really concerned about are future generations of people. And this gets to the whole intergenerational justice issue. I think if we look now at what we're doing to the planet, which is using up resources at a faster rate than nature is replenishing them, which is kind of like spending your savings account faster than it is being replenished with interest. What that says is when you spend your savings and your savings account decreases in value, that is, in effect, taking away from the inheritance of your children. And now that's certainly an okay thing for a person to do because they earned that, they saved it, they intended to live on that for their retirements. But when you're talking about the whole planet and us dipping, you know, expending the bounty that God gave us at a rate faster than natural creation can replenish that bounty, then we are depriving from all future generations that follow us. And to just kind of provide a little bit of further kind of structure to this idea of justice, there was a writer, his last name was Rawls, I can't remember the first one. He wrote a book called Theory of Justice. It came out in the late 70s. But what he suggested we needed to do when thinking rationally and dispassionately about justice was to put ourselves behind a veil of ignorance and look at the world as though we didn't know what social class we belong to, that we didn't know what the state of our health was, that we didn't even know what the kind of a country we belonged to, what race we were, what language we spoke, or even what the social customs were. That without knowing where God was going to situate us in this society on planet Earth, what kind of a system would we like so that we'd be in pretty good shape no matter where we ended up? And that's what he called the veil of ignorance, is that a just society is one where behind the veil of ignorance, you'd say, okay, I wouldn't mind living in that society. I would consider that to be a just society. And I wonder how many of us today, behind a veil of ignorance, presented with the society of today in America, that we would be willing to take a chance on being poor or being black or being, because we wouldn't know what race God says, okay, Flo, we're behind a veil of ignorance now, and your lottery ticket just came up, and you're going to live with poor black folks in the projects of the Bronx. And you'd want to know, well, what's the projects of the Bronx mean? And hopefully this just society would say, well, you're poor, but this society has taken very good care of you. This is a clean place, safe, no crime, no drugs, and your children will get well educated. You know, that's one society for a poor person. Because behind the veil of ignorance, we may decide, well, it's good to have diversity. It's good to have some rich people who can kind of blow a wad of money on some wild project and do something different than most folks do. But he goes one step further about the veil of ignorance. He says that behind the veil of ignorance, people should have no information as to which generation they belong. So they also don't know when they're going to be plucked by God behind this veil to go on this planet Earth. And I wonder how many people today would say, well, given the growth rate down there and the rate of exploitation of the forests and you know, the desertification that's going on and the climate change and the, you know, the loss of the biodiversity of the species and the other unstoppable trends of the six unstoppable trends we've talked about in the first class, how many would take their chance on being born today in this world? Now, many of you said, you know, looking at those cartoon pictures, I think, you know, maybe I wish I was born maybe 150 years ago. When the grass was green and lots of forests and there was that good mud hole for us to swim in, you know. I think animal rights activists would go even one step further about
the... all people? They'd get rid of all the people?
Well, no, the animal rights activists would go one step further about what the veil of ignorance means. They would say, you also don't even know what species you're going to be. Now, how many of us would like to be born into this world as a chicken on one of Mr. Perdue's chicken farms? Or
I'd like to come back as my house cat, but not a chicken.
Yes, I can be come back as somebody's dog.
But
other creatures.
The animal rights folks take a very global perspective about what justice means. And they would say, behind the veil of ignorance, we should be able to be we should be willing at least to create conditions in which, if we were born a pig, or a chicken, or an eagle, or a salmon, that we'd say, okay, I can go for that. That a just society is one in which all creatures have opportunities to be actualized and for their evolution to proceed according to God's plan. So that's a broader conception of justice, and I think that this a lot of this is embodied in the heart of the Old and New Testaments with the concern for the oppressed.
Are you going to talk about the six trends? Not the six trends, but...
Why don't you talk briefly about the money and poverty thing?
I'm going to be really quick on this. And you're probably familiar with the very strong theme, particularly in the New Testament and in the prophets and the Hebrew scriptures, about money and material wealth being a block. A possible block for the kingdom of God. It's been very interesting in the Presbyterian Church, I know, as in other denominations, for the last several years, probably the biggest debate raging is on the gay and lesbian issue. One of the things that most struck me in a conversation about that, they were studying Paul's letters where it lists all the sins, that the things that make the Gentiles unclean. And if it's very interesting, if you look at every list, greed is always on the list. And it's very interesting that we have these ferocious ethical debates about sexual orientation, but I think the sin that most of us buy into in some way or another, and certainly as a society, is the greed. And I think it was probably no different in Jesus' time. That there were wealthy people at the expense of poor, and that Jesus' message very much in the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor. It's easier for the camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. That theme is very strong. And it's tempting to want to read, to interpret that in other ways. I've had conversations with people. I in seminary, there was a professor I had who lived very simply. And she said she believed that when Jesus said, sell all you have and give it to the poor, that's really clear. And I've had a number of discussions with people who say, well, that was just in that particular situation. But I think it's very easy to want to rationalize and tone it down, particularly in regards to the environment. Living more simply is a common sense thing, as well as a message we have strongly from the Gospels. I won't have time to read the whole...
What I will do, though, is this is an article, a story about the virtues of living simply that we'll give you copies of. But maybe if you could summarize portion of it.
It's about a man whose life at 55... changed radically. His wife died and he lost his job, and he was at a place in his life where he needed to make a very central change. And so he decided, after 6 months, he was given he bought a $55 bicycle. And the bicycle basically revolutionized his life. He started biking to work, And then he decided, well, you know, he really didn't have to have that particular job. He moved into a very small building on the property of a friend, so he didn't have to pay for a mortgage. He had time then to volunteer at things he enjoyed doing that he felt like were meaningful. He had time to ride his bike. He learned how to take care of all of it, so he didn't have to pay someone to fix it for him. He says, now I go around town hassling people with tales of my biking prowess. I pedal everywhere and bore everybody. When it rains, I get wet. Stashes of dry clothes are stored in homes in strategic corners of the city. I've written a dozen poems about my conversion. Sunday, I went to a picnic with a 10-gallon container of tea balanced on my bike rack, then played 7 volleyball games and outlasted all these svelte young women and weightlifting men half my age. I found a job working 20 hours a week as a receptionist in a women's center. It's only $5 an hour, but the work is meaningful, the company pleasant, and it's easy on a man growing old. There's a bedroom on the premises, and I share the bathroom and kitchen. This bedroom is only 6 by 20 feet. The house I sold is 2,700 square feet. But my room holds everything I need to dress, sleep, read, or even write an article like this. There's a telephone and a typewriter at the reception desk, but I spend most of my time in the kitchen cooking for everyone. In return for free rent and utilities, I work an additional 10 hours a week. I've turned into a bit of a miser. My ledger for October 1991 indicates I spent $281.75, but I earned more than $415. My biggest expense is food, but my new garden helps. Anyway, he goes on to describe the simple life, and here's how it closes. Today, I live a simple life on 2 wheels, some ball bearings, and a few gears. This morning, I wrote a poem, Living Simply. Here is my bedroom. Here is my chest of drawers and my bookcase. Here is my little desk and my chair. Here is my lamp. Here is my bicycle. Here is my poem.
In the time remaining, I'd like to talk a little bit about death and resurrection, and then open it up to some discussion. As we mentioned in the class on sin, in Jesus' time, he was alerting the people of his time to the fact that all of society was in darkness, that everyone was, with the exception of perhaps a few, including Isaac and Jesus, was following a false god, that there was idolatry in the land. And that is a valuable part of our tradition, the idea based on the history of a people that had a very strong sense of an intimate relationship of God, that somehow strayed from what they knew they were called to be as a people and a people of God, and were living in darkness. It is possible for a whole society to live in darkness, and before there can be light, something is going to have to die. There will have to be a death before the world, the human race, has a resurrection. And I want to suggest a little bit about what that might consist of. There is an economist who I happen to know and worked with at the Stanford Research Institute, who says something that I think comes close to what I think the darkness is today in the world. He says that every society has some kind of an organizing myth. Traditional societies had one, medieval society had one, and we have one. Very central to our modern myth is the idea that it's perfectly reasonable that the economy should be the paramount institution around which everything else revolves, and that economic logic and economic values should guide our decisions. This all seems so natural that we never think to question it, and yet there are profound reasons why we should question it. The domination by the economy rests on these basic assumptions: that any organization must grow or die. So growth is an inherent assumption in the economy. The economy as a whole must grow exponentially. Labor productivity must continue to increase. Owners have the right to receive maximum return on their investments. And you can kind of put in parentheses, society be damned. And unbridled competition is a good thing with a few minor exceptions. He goes on to say, and this, I don't know if I mentioned his name is Willis Harmon, a noted futurist. And futurists are kind of folks who kind of do things like we were doing with the cartoon exercise this morning. They kind of peer off into the future and see what it looks like. And he's one of those kinds of folks. But he goes on to say that if you were to look at the goals that not only this society, but any human society seems to aim toward, you come up with a very different picture and different assumptions. What we really want is a wholesome environment in which to raise our children. And interestingly, conventional economics, you read a conventional economics text, there isn't a chapter on how to raise children. There's nothing. It's a lot about how to, the flow of money in the banking system, what is the optimal rate of interest, creation of credit. But is there a chapter on raising children in your economics book? No. And I know, I mean, I've taken several curricula. I have two graduate degrees in economics, so
not even budgeting for a college education.
But it's not a chapter on that either. There's another goal. We want a good relationship with nature. It's a very paramount goal we all have, a very human goal. There's nothing in any economic textbooks about that. In fact, there's no chapter in any economic text about human values, really, except maybe self-interest and the utility function, the declining law of diminishing returns, the declining rate of marginal utility. Basically, that's the only psychology you will ever get in an economics textbook. So the more you consume, the less you want to consume. So the more sugar you eat, you know, imagine, you know, eating 10 chocolate bars, right? Well, by the fifth chocolate bar, you're getting kind of sick. By the 10th, you never want to touch chocolate again. Maybe that's a good way to get
it. I don't know about that.
But that's all the psychology.
Good theory.
That is the extent of psychology in economics. So the second premise that we all have is we want a good relationship with nature. Third, we want to feel safe. And fourth, we want to hold certain values like democracy, liberty, the rule of law, equity, and justice, and so on. Those are important values, and they are not economic values. They transcend economics. But in our current, in this world of darkness, increasingly, all values are becoming subordinated to economic efficiency. And this, I'm proposing, is one of the things that's going to have to die before there is a resurrection. I want to talk a little bit more in practical terms about where there is a feast to come, where there is hope for the future. Not strictly in biblical terms, but in going back a little bit to the first five sessions to recap a little bit what we said about nature and the dynamics of the natural world and the interaction of human and ecological systems. Paul Ehrlich, who is a noted demographer and population expert, once had a simple equation to explain what our impact was on the planet. And it's made up of three components, and they multiply with one another. They are multiplicative, not additive. He said impact, or I, equals population times consumption times technology. And I have some additional equations up here. The population is a function of something I call values. Consumption is a function of values and technology. The technology we use, our choices as a society, is a function of values. And what are values? How do we get values? I think the Bible tells us a little bit about how we get values, whether we admit it or not consciously. But I have values are a function of HS. Anyone have a guess of what HS is?
Holy Spirit.
That is, the Holy Spirit is the traditional language for how God operates in our world today. And if we believe that God is with us, that we are a God-filled world and a God-filled universe, there is a Holy Spirit that informs our values. And right now we are in this world of darkness, and the Spirit is there, but we are listening to other messages coming at us from T, or technology, communications technology, television, radio, all the media. Now I want to provide a little bit of hope. First, on population. It has been estimated by some demographers that for everyone in the planet to enjoy our standard of living, the planet can only support 2 billion people. And that's even assuming we recycle everything, we use maximum efficient technology. We derive our fuels from alcohol, from biomass. We do lots of things to really conserve on non-renewable inputs to the economy. If every couple has 1.5 children on average, which is the equivalent to half of all couples electing to have 2 children and the other half electing to have only 1 child, we will reduce our current population of 5.7 billion to 2 billion in 100 years. That rate of reproduction is now a reality in Germany, and in fact Italy is below that at 1.3. So it is possible for a whole society to be at the level of growth that can assure us a population level that is much more in balance with the resources that can be provided to us. And as we discussed in class 5, just to recap, there are many people in just China alone that want our level of standard of living. So this is a real problem, which gets next to the question of consumption. I work at the Bonneville Power Administration in the area of energy conservation, and I know from firsthand experience how much is being wasted just in electricity. And if any of you have done garbology here at Holden, you will know how much food gets wasted. And we're probably pretty efficient in our use of food here. Tremendous strides can be made to maintain our standard of living while consuming less. I don't know how many of you go to garage sales, but you will often go into people's homes and just see their garages full, their closets stuffed, they're up to the gills with stuff. We are full of stuff in our society that never gets shared, that never gets shared, that hardly ever gets used. It's in, while economics is concerned with economic efficiency, in fact, we are extremely inefficient in our use of resources. We all have our own lawnmowers, our own cars, our own ladders, our own things that we hardly use. We all have to have our own. And it's unusual for someone to come across the street anymore and say, do you have something that I can borrow? I'll give it right back.